6:15, and I'm convinced that Paul Rohde gave me the 6:15 time because he knew that chapel was at 7:30 and I couldn't run late. So he knows me well. But the series of talks, I'm Mike Mullen. I'm from Augustana College. I'm trained as an American colonial historian. And I have done a fair amount of writing on British policy towards the American Indian. Because of where I'm located, there are very few 18th century texts to decipher and to look at. I've moved into the late 19th century, and my current project concerns a South Dakota senator by the name of R.F. Pettigrew and his opposition to Hawaiian annexation. The result of that opposition, John Adams would have told him this is the case, the result of that opposition was he lost his re-election bid. But he is a hero in Hawaii. And so Hawaiians know the story of R.F. Pettigrew better than most South Dakotans do. So we're going to talk a little bit, and here's what I'm hoping over the next 4 days. That we generate conversation, and I've got a few quotes that I want us to talk about specifically, but I also, without saying here's the direct connection, I hope we see a relevance to today. And I think that's increasingly important. One of the genesis of my talks is the Rick Santorum fiasco when he criticized the John F. Kennedy. It's not that he criticized it, although I think he was wrong to criticize it in the way he did. It shows a distinct lack of knowledge about where this nation was in 1960 relative to Protestantism, Catholicism. And I think we have to keep that in the back of our mind. So what I want to do is kind of give you the premise and the context before we talk about John Adams. I think that the stories that we tell about the past help us to contextualize it, okay? We see today as the political scene, the religious dialogue or lack thereof, is incredibly nasty, ugly. And yes, I did paraphrase Thomas Hobbes, but that's okay. Instead of being short, we would have said mercifully short if that was the case, it seems to get longer and longer, and so we get more and more upset. And there seems to be kind of an impetus. And so what I think we need to realize is that there's nothing new. What's different is how we've dealt with it, or have not dealt with it. We don't challenge people to duels anymore, okay? That's how Andrew Jackson would have done it. The other kind of premise, and as a historian I take solace in this, is that the issues of today are not new. What is the relationship between church and state? What ought that relationship to be? Who is to decide what that relationship is? How do you protect the oppressed? What's the proper role of government if you're Adams and Jefferson? And I think if we understand how earlier generations used their understanding of what it meant to be a Christian or what it meant to be a statesman, we would be better off. And lastly, all five of the men I'm going to talk about, and maybe if you become a historian, and in 30 years you're invited to speak, maybe it won't be just men we're talking about. But the five men I've chosen for particular reasons, but all of them lived through a religious revival. And I would argue that we are living through, whether we like it or not, a religious revival right now. It seems to be on the right of the religious spectrum as opposed to the left, which is how the first and second Great Awakening were. But the fourth Great Awakening, which no one writes about, but it is in the 1890s, that kind of was a rightist movement as well. So we're living in a time in which we ought to expect this. All right? So that's the kind of context and the premise. Let me begin with a very quick story. I had a hard time getting to Holden. Okay?
Don't we all?
Yeah, we all do. But my $100 taxi ride made it even more difficult, okay, to get from Wenatchee here. Because I had missed the bus that was going to get me to the boat that don't communicate. Anyway, the guy picks me up. We've got 50 minutes to get from Wenatchee, maybe we're down to 40 at this point, to Fields Landing, where I obviously made it. But he says, so what are you doing? I say, well, I'm a historian. Oh, I love history. I love history. What are you going to do? I'm going to Holden, and I'm going to talk about politics and religion and American politics. Oh, I love religion. Right? And so we start going, and we're dialoguing. And the more we talk, the slower he goes. Now, the kicker is that this gentleman was well-read in what he read, but he said, you know, I homeschooled my own kids, and I did it because I hate revisionist history. And I started thinking, I think what you mean is you just hate modern interpretations. I didn't say it, but he didn't like the new science, he didn't like the new history, I didn't ask about foreign language. Now, I want to give the guy credit. His kids are all in college, okay, so we just take it. But I said, so he says to me, yeah, all the history books we use had to be published before 1961. So I'm doing some math and say, okay, so before civil rights, before Vietnam, good white Anglo-Saxon Protestant interpretations of American history. Okay. He said, I wish I could go hear your talks because it's nice to talk to a historian who knows something about religion. I said, I just don't think we're reading the same, the books that, you know. So, this taxi ride became a summation of what John Fea, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, F-E-A is the way he spells his last name. He wrote a really interesting book, and I'm going to lean heavily on it this week, at least for the first two of our authors, called Was America Ever a Christian Nation? Now, before you run out by the book looking for an answer, he doesn't answer it. And he doesn't answer because he's going to ask you a question, and we're going to address the question. Are we interested when we ask that question, is America a Christian nation? Are we interested in the answer's orthodoxy? That is what a person says he believes. Or are we interested in the practice of, say, orthopraxy? That is, how does someone practice their faith day to day? If you use that definition, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln are never, ever going to be elected president today. They are not orthodox in their thought practice when it comes to Christianity. Woodrow Wilson and John Kennedy fit the orthodoxy test. I don't know as much about Wilson's private life as we seem to know about Kennedy's. But I think most would say Kennedy kind of ushers in the beginning of not practicing the orthodox test when it comes to things like marriage and fidelity and those types of things. Now, don't get upset, I'm Catholic. I can say that about our only Catholic president, okay? But this is an important question. This is an important idea. The reason it's important is that the polarization of America, where left won't talk to right, where one religious sect won't talk to another religious sect, where we can't discuss meanings of faith, not just within traditions, but across traditions, allows fringe groups, small groups, to take center stage. And if you heard the 4 o'clock talk in this room on evolution and religion, that was part of the conversation. That is, we don't have this kind of silent middle talking about what's the interconnectedness. It's the extremes that are doing it. They might not be the majority. In fact, we know they're not. But they seem to dominate the space. And I would argue that polarization has allowed both theologians, but I'm thinking primarily politicians here, so bear with me, to misuse history. They're cherry-picking. They're acting as lawyers They like this case, so what they're going to do is they're going to say, here's my example, this proves my point. Even if it's one out of a thousand, they pick the one that's going to fit there, and they'll ignore the complexity of the question. They'll ignore the complexity of the issue, and they will deny that those other quotes matter, because they've got their one. John Barton, who's kind of writing of America as God's agent, he argues, and I admire him for his honesty, he says, I practice like a lawyer practices, not as a historian practices. You pick, right, what fits your argument. The rest of the facts be darned. And that is frustrating to a historian. It's really useful for television. It's really useful for those who have an agenda. But is ultimately corrosive to civility, not just in the secular sense, but in the religious sense as well. So I love this cartoon. I thought about starting with it. Under restoration, and this is true. No president in the last 20 years has undergone a greater revision than John Adams. And there's a reason for it. Now, when I started thinking about this, I didn't like John Adams, okay? I'm a Jeffersonian. Warts and all. John Adams was a short, fat, bald rotundity. You know, he's just a snickering, provincial dweeb who idolizes England. Jefferson, right, you know, worldly, thinker, famous, slavery. Okay, I'll take that part too. But yeah, like, he's just... And he had red hair. Great. Okay. But the more you look at Adams, the more you have to respect him. He's one of two presidents who sacrificed a second term, I would argue, for the betterment of the nation. And this is what started. In 1800, we were fighting a quasi-war with France. He was told by Alexander Hamilton, he was told by others, you know, if we just continue this war without declaring it, you'll be reelected. We're on war footing. You know, you always vote for the guy that's in office during war. Instead, John Adams sent a peace envoy, negotiated an end to this struggle with France. And in doing so, he fractured what was then called the Federalist Party. And that's what allowed Thomas Jefferson to win the 1800 presidential election. The second president, I would argue, that kind of fits that category is the first George Bush, where he allowed Congress to raise taxes, right, and he got jumped all over by those on the right, where they came back and say, read my lips, no new taxes, said you're a liar. And it really was the end of his second term, the possibility. All right, so having said that, let's be honest, John Adams is an afterthought. He's not the first president, he's second. He didn't get credit for the Declaration of Independence. He helped write it. He's the first president not to get reelected. And he doesn't really seem to do much after he leaves office, right? He's always second fiddle. And so he hasn't gotten credit where it's due. But he's drawn the attention of scholars as diverse as Paige Smith. Those not historians and under the age of 50 will never have heard of Paige Smith. He wrote A People's History of the United States. He's probably dead by now. Professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. But it was a very bottom-up history at a time in which history was being written top-down. So leftist historian looked at it, and he liked him very much, Paige Smith did. He wrote a whole two-volume biography on John Adams. But he's also been looked at by David McCullough, and you don't get much more mainstream than David McCullough, right? If David McCullough writes on you, you are on the bestseller list, you become important, they make movies about you, miniseries about you, and everybody knows something about David McCullough's offers, right? So both left and right find something in Adams that you don't find in other people. And one of the reasons for this, I think, is that when you read about Adams, he was either a very warm friend. He did everything and anything for you. that he could. And he did on occasion extend himself a little bit too far to help friends. But he was also mean-spirited. He carried grudges. You know, and I don't want to bore you, we have to be done, but do you know the history of Jefferson and Adams in any way? They started as very good friends. In 1796, before we had the two president and vice president on the same ticket, they were nominated. They represented two different sides of the political spectrum, so it would be like having pick who you want as president and vice president, Obama and Mitt Romney, or Mitt Romney and Obama in the White House. And they didn't speak to each other. And they didn't speak to each other for over 18 years. And it was Abigail Adams who finally got the two of them to kind of let grudges be grudges. And even in death, right, they competed. Because both die on July the 4th, 1826. Now, fortunately for Adams, but this is classic Adams, right? He's dying. What is he thinking? Not of Abigail, or not of his children. Damn, you know, he says, Jefferson has outlived me. Not knowing that Jefferson had died 2 hours earlier. So he wasted his last breath, you know, on a curse in essence, or a darn that he didn't need to make. But that's just kind of how they are. He is, however, despite everything, most difficult to nail down when it comes to his religious ideas, his religious thinking. And so let's look, and I'm hoping that we can get some conversation at some Adams quotes, and you'll see why this is. In a letter to Benjamin Rush, he wrote, "I am a church-going animal." What's that mean?
Habit
would be one, yeah.
His wife herds him and his children to church every Sunday.
You know, can we come back to that? No, because I hadn't thought about it, put it that way. But when they were able to go to church, they did go together, right? But John Adams did place the religious training of his children in Abigail's hands. And this brought him much grief with the son that you know, John Quincy Adams, as we'll see in just a little bit. He was quite disappointed in his son. Even though he's going to become president, he's going to become congressman, I mean, he lives... But he did. Any other thoughts? So his wife's leaving him church, he's just going out of habit?
Instinct,
okay.
Politics.
Right thing to do, right? You have to belong to a church. Let's get it together and they'll see me.
Well, depending on what he means by animal, there could be a food chain implication, or, you know, like he's vicious or sort of after him or antagonistic or something like that.
He could. Let's take it a step further. What Adams is a regular churchgoer, okay? But Adams is going to consume what he can see and observe and hear. So while Adams will always see himself as a Protestant, and he will say horrible things about the Catholics, Adams regularly goes to Catholic Mass. He regularly goes to hear the New Life ministers preaching. He will hear George Whitefield. He is going to consume to see what's there. So when he's talking about this, he sees himself going out, if you will, getting energy, trying to figure out what it is in this structure, in this meaning. Why are we doing this? So he's going not to be told what he already knows. He's hunting for something. He's seeking to figure out something he doesn't know. And this, I think, is going to be one of the great lessons that Adams, right, I called him this provincial buffoon kind of guy that I've had to reconsider, that Adams teaches us. He's not going for confirmation of what he already knows. It may come from what he disagrees with, but he's going to see if there's something he missed. So this we can go. Justice, kindness, piety, charity. These are the ideals of my faith. He could have added frugality, I think, but that would have been.
They all have social implications.
That's a great insight, right? That is, this is this question of orthodoxy versus orthopraxy. That is, what good does it do to have a set of beliefs or tenets if you do not operate on those tenets? And that's kind of what we heard with Adam's story this morning. What Adams in this letter, they were corresponding, because John's in Philadelphia and Abigail's in Braintree. And I need to put this to rest, because it really bothers me. You know, you've all heard it in these letters that he calls her a farmeress. Yes? That he writes, soon you'll be a farmeress, you know? And lots of people jumped in, oh, what a sexist dog John Adams is. Oh, you know, how he wouldn't even call her a farmer. The people who argue that have not looked at an 18th century dictionary yet.
No.
Because farmer is masculine in the 18th century. It carries an M after the word. He was paying her the ultimate compliment by creating a word for her saying, you are the equal of. So he's writing to Abigail, and they're writing on business, they're writing on all these things. He, unlike so many other 18th century leaders, he sees Abigail as a partner. And so they're talking, and the question is, what are the things that we need to instill in our children that will allow them to lead, in his phrase, a good Christian life? And he says you can distill it in this, justice, kindness, piety, charity. And then in classic Puritan sense it says, and if they don't display this, beat them. Right? You can only go so far. He's kind of, yes, and if we have to beat it out of you, we're going to beat it out of him. And John Quincy did not like that. That's one of the issues. But in a sense, this notion that it doesn't do any good to have a faith if it doesn't lead to action is what's going to drive John Adams and in his life. And it's one of the reasons why John Adams will not claim, he does belong to a church, but John Adams will never claim to belong to an Orthodox church. He says, I cannot become a full member. I cannot undergo the conversion experience. I cannot become part of that. So as vice president, this debate occurs about should, and we'll talk more about this in the next few days, why isn't God in the Constitution? Does that mean we are not following a Christian context? So he's writing letters, and it is resignation to God. It is goodness itself to man. That is what defines a Christian. It is not belonging to a church. It is not being a vestryman in a church. It is not having, in the 18th century, you paid for your seats. It's not having the family pew up at the front. If you don't go, you can still, in John Adams' view, do good works. That is, goodness itself to man is ultimately what defines a good Christian. If you have, right, justice, kindness, piety, charity, you're going to be good to your fellow neighbor. And these questions about should we, could we, how do we bury someone who's not of our faith or the color of our skin, those things shouldn't matter. So far, you know, Adams could slide pretty easily. He could fit the Anglican. He probably couldn't fit the Baptist yet. But this next quote is what gets him in the most trouble. And the exclamations are his in the text. They are not mine, okay? An incarnate God, an eternal, self-existent, omnipresent, omniscient, and author of the stupendous universe suffering on the cross, My soul starts at horror at this idea. And it should be, I always think it should be, you know, kind of, it starts as an odd phrase. He is rejecting the Trinity. This is what gets Adams in trouble. He had listened to Joseph Priestley. They had long correspondence. Unitarianism is going to emerge in the 19th century as kind of the intellectual religion. But John Adams sees himself as a Unitarian. He has serious questions about the resurrection. Now, if you come back tomorrow, so does Jefferson. Okay? Adams is not alone here. And there's something, and I throw that out now because this strikes us as really odd. I mean, how can... But in the 18th century, with the Enlightenment, with other things, there's a real sense that the resurrection is food. That it's made up. Equally important, at least in the case of Jefferson, less so in Adams. It doesn't matter. Because the teachings, right, of justice, kindness, piety, charity, and doing good to man, that's really what any society should need. Have we added layers? Adams is going to argue. But this, as you can imagine, produces a few problems for Adams. Yeah, my goodness, we thought we raised you properly. Now, look at who he's writing this to. So can you see? He's writing it to his son, the future president of the United States, who got there by a corrupt bargain, but still became president. He's upset with his son because his son came to believe in the Trinity. And he thought his son was kind of going willy-nilly with the winds and not doing his own rational thinking. In part, it's generational, this fight. But Adams is unable, and this brings him some heartache. He's unable to reconcile what he believes Christianity really is with what his son ultimately comes to articulate. So Adams does not fit the orthodoxy test. Right? I can see CNN, I can see Fox, I can see C-SPAN jumping all over this. While he's going, he's not believing. Or while he's believing, he's not going. I'm a historian, so the question is not, is he right about what he believes? The real question is, why? Why would he do this? And how does this have anything to do with his notion of religious pluralism? Or his defense of religious pluralism? You have to remember, the Founding Fathers, and I'd separate the Founding Fathers into two groups, okay? There is the revolutionary group. The Washington, the Jefferson, the Adams, those who, if you will, made a nation. And then there is the second Founding Father group, the John Jays, the Alexander Hamilton, the James Madisons, those who wrote the Constitution, those who decided how, with this nation, we can keep it going. And they have fundamentally different perspectives on the world. In part, a result of fighting in the Revolution. Adams and Jefferson are not soldiers in the Revolution. Hamilton is. He sees what corruption can do. And John Quincy Adams, for his part, always felt that he had gotten cheated. Because when his dad went to England as ambassador and kind of groveled to get recognized in the 1780s, John Quincy thought that he should have been home somehow participating in the making. So there's a lot here. So why would Adams come to believe in this? Now, one answer is, we're not going to spend a lot of time on it, John Locke's Two Treatises of Government. Okay? Much has been made of this. By the way, Jefferson, who we assume knew Locke's treatise better than anyone, Jefferson never owned two treatises on government by law. Though we know he knew it, right? Because Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness is a ripoff on Life, Liberty, and Land, which is what Locke argues. Adams did own it. And he marked it up pretty well. Adams lives in a particular world. He's raised as a Congregationalist, as a Calvinist. And in Calvinism, particularly in the 18th century, if you're Dutch Reform, this may strike you as still the way. But the Calvinists believe you're pretty much damned to hell. Unless you went through the conversion experience, it didn't matter how good you were. You were going to hell. And this is, well, we'll talk about it, but this is a big issue in 18th century. And this is why Adams' inability to become a full church member is so problematic. In the 18th century, if you're not a full church member, you cannot get into heaven. Now, fortunately, the halfway covenant, this agreement, allowed him to baptize his children because he could claim, "I'm trying to get there." But the Congregationalist world is pretty negative. And ultimately, this is what moves John Adams away from the Congregationalist experience. He came to believe that Calvinism emphasized the depravity of man too much. And Adams believed, because of the Revolution, because of other things, that ultimately there is a seed of goodness in all humans. That we were not depraved from the get-go. And that kind of split is the root of his journey. His father wanted him to become a minister, so we know he was raised a good Congregationalist, but he became a lawyer instead. It's the exact opposite of Martin Luther. Right? Luther's dad wants him to be a lawyer. That thunderstorm and prayer to St. Anne changes everything. I have to be honest. I think Adams made a good choice. He was a horrible school teacher for the 2 years that he was reading the law, okay, trying to figure out what he's going to do. If he had become a minister, I can just see him in poverty. Just no one coming. I mean, his temperament, he just wouldn't have been a good minister. So he picked wisely. But he picked wisely for another reason. He lived during a period of time known as the Great Awakening. You've probably all heard of Jonathan Edwards, the most famous sermon, right? Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. The Great Awakening is a fight. I mean, that's really the only way you can put it. A fight over what conversion means, who can determine conversion, and then to our ears, this will sound very, very odd. But in the 18th century, it's the crux of the issue. Is conversion permanent? In classic Calvinist thought, you never knew. You might have gone through the world's greatest conversion experience, and they weren't fun. And you might do really well, and all things might point to being part of the elect. But you never knew. Humans had no control over that. The conversion experience said, "I think I'm going there." But God ultimately makes the decision. The question of whether you get into heaven, whether you're saved, all of the afterlife has nothing to do with you. It has to do with the decision God makes. I'm kind of subconsciously right, thinking about that text where he compares God's hand over you when you're the spider climbing down, and no matter what you do to climb up that, if God pulls away his hand, if the person pulls away his hand, the fires of hell will engulf you. No matter what, even if you've changed your life, this is conversion. A group emerged, Gilbert Tennent, they called themselves New Lights. And though it was not Jonathan Edwards' intent, those who heard Jonathan Edwards speak, and Adams would have been one, those who heard Edwards came to believe that if they sought the conversion experience, they were saved permanently. Now, in the 21st century, we tend to have that kind of permanence. We tend to be of the argument that it is our decision that leads to salvation. That's going to be the second great awakening. That would be Abraham Lincoln on Wednesday or Tuesday, all right, where we get to that one. But this was radical. But what was equally radical about this conversion is the people undergoing it tended to be poor, they tended to be young, and they tended to face a pretty darn bleak future. Now, you've all heard politicians tell you this, and I tell my class this, and they laugh. I hope they use it. We ought to return to old-fashioned values. We ought to return to Puritan values, right? Those were the good old days. 75% of the women who went to the altar in Northampton, where Jonathan Edwards was youth pastor in the 1730s, went to the altar pregnant. 75%. Now, how do we know that? Because you open up the family Bible, they have the date of the marriage, and then you list when the children were born. And so it's pretty simple math. You look at the date, you look at the marriage. Now, why? They're usually about 3 months. Just enough to be sure, not yet enough that really is going to cause a problem, but enough for mom and dad to say it's time to get married. Now, they're getting married for real reasons, okay? By getting married, a young woman forces her parents to give them a dowry. Because no dad, no mom wants their daughter to have, we've all read the Scarlet Letter, unmarried. Fathers were willing to grant their sons land because they needed something to raise food on. When they granted them land, the young man became an adult in the eyes of the law. And by having his wife and having a child, they became independent entities. So I'm not saying they're doing it out there to kind of immoral. They thought this through. And just so you know, Jonathan Edwards, as youth pastor, let children bundle in his bedroom. Bundling was when a young man and young woman would sleep together. Now, theoretically, with clothes on. But not always. Can you imagine? I think a youth pastor would be fired in a moment if they were to do that today. Okay? The point here is, look what's just happening. A new group is deciding that they can control their own fate. The group that is participating in this movement is able now to say, I have been chosen, you have not. I am more moral than you. Jonathan Edwards has to leave Northampton because he has not undergone a conversion experience. Adams would be aghast at this great mind, this intellectual giant, and you're casting him out so he can go be president of some new school called Princeton. He dies 3 days after he arrives because he got a smallpox inoculation. They gave him too much of the pox, and he died. But that's a whole different lecture on science and religion in the 18th century, okay? So the Great Awakening has these implications. But the upshot of this for today is that new religions emerged. The Baptists really take off at this point. And Baptists have problems. They are not allowed to practice openly in places like Virginia. They set up shop in Pennsylvania, a Quaker colony. And the Baptists and Presbyterians that come, they're not pacifist. And how do we why would a Baptist want to pay a tithe to the state to fund a church that they don't attend? This was the state of both Virginia and of New England. So what the Great Awakening does is it produces, unlike Europe, a religious heterogeneity, primarily Protestant, but a heterogeneity that becomes to believe different things, that take on different orthodoxies. And they're willing, in some cases, to go to blows over this. At the same time, the lesser sorts, as the text would say, are getting religion. The intellectuals are getting a different type of religion, the Enlightenment. And I use the term specifically, a new different type of religion. They're going to come to believe as fervently in this branch of knowledge as those that work for them may believe in their religious salvation. Ultimately, the Enlightenment thinkers and those participating in the bundling sessions at Northampton are hoping for the same thing. An understanding of God and a guide for how I ought to live. What they're both looking for is some understanding of God and the universe. For us, what draws Adams, and this is kind of the lawyer in him, what draws Adams' attention to the Enlightenment is its focus on the knowable, if you will, on the rational, but also on the provable. Right? This is not just in science. This is in social science. Can we prove this? Can we do this? At least in the 18th century. So when Adams is going to write the Constitution for Massachusetts, he's not just writing in the abstract. He's looking for examples of what worked, what didn't, and where failure occurred. He could prove this was better than that, the few and the many working together, than the one or the few or the many alone. Why? Because the Greeks tell us that. What happened when Rome got an emperor? Okay, civility and morality disappear. Now, we can quibble about whether this is science. But what the Enlightenment was ultimately after was improving the world, making the world better. If you read Denis Diderot's Encyclopedia, that's the focus of the book. How do we improve society? And that's what Adams is going to try and do with his Constitution. That's what Jefferson and others, Madison, Jay, are going to try and do with their writings. We're going to try and improve society to make it better. If we make it better, then God's kingdom can possibly come. So here's a picture of Joseph Priestley. He's often considered the father of Unitarianism. Okay? I had the great pleasure, I want to say, 2 years ago, maybe three, whenever I went on sabbatical. I'm National Endowment for Humanities Chair of Regional Studies at Augustana. And one of my jobs is to kind of promote history in the region, but particularly local and regional history. And so I was involved in bringing a John Adams exhibit from the Adams Library to Watertown Public Library in South Dakota. And the exhibit consisted of panels of John Adams Library. And one of Adams' sections was entitled God. He had a whole section in his library and entitled God. Now, if you look at that section, this religious section had books in a variety of languages. So remember, he's this animal going to different churches, checking things out. But there were at least six books in French. There were even more in Latin. He struggled with Dutch, but he had a couple. And Spanish texts. Now, this isn't in his political science. This isn't in his service community. This is in religion, in the search for God. The books cover both contemporary issues and ancient issues. What did the ancients believe? What did Christianity borrow from Judaism? What was the Reformation ultimately about? What were the differences between Calvin and Luther? Interesting, he also asked, what did those who didn't believe either say about those? He had, and I just picked two of these, right? Gobelins Lay the Primitive World alongside Dossier's Bibliotheque of the Ancients, the bibliography of ancient texts. What did they think? Now, this he's going to share with others. just as Luther argued that the church had added layers to what it meant to be a Christian, John Adams believes that Calvinism and Protestantism are doing exactly the same thing. That the clergy have a vested interest in clouding up what Christianity is really about. Now, he's not a primitivist, and that's kind of Jefferson. But he is convinced that state religion, or any church that is sponsored by the state, has a vested interest in not the truth, not salvation, but maintaining its position. And all they had to do was look at Braintree, or Lexington, but really Concord, where you have the North Church and the South Church, and those communities are split entirely. What was or what is truthful? That's what he's kind of after. Now, as I've said a couple times now, Joseph Priestley figures prominently in this collection. I'm not trying to kind of focus on Unitarianism, but this, I think, was the biggest surprise to me. Because I always assume of Unitarianism really taking off about 1819, 1820 at Harvard, and in particular the Divinity School, I hadn't really thought about it as an 18th century event. But Adams has a large correspondence with Priestley. Now, this is the other thing that we need to know. That in his library, he had a Quran, which he'd read and marked up, and he had a Catholic Bible. Now, that's great, right? What he's done is engage the other. Now, as I've said, he hates Catholics. Fortunately, there aren't a lot of Muslims in Boston, in Braintree, yet. And so he really doesn't have to confront that bias. But it wasn't enough to read them. He corresponded with people he knew who were experts in Catholicism or in Islam. He wanted to make sure that what he read as he interpreted it was the correct interpretation. Not to bash it, not to say you're wrong, but to help him understand the other religions. My guess is most of us have not read the Quran. I'll be honest, I tried. I got lost. I also got even more lost in the Book of Mormon. Okay? But I tried. He got through them, I think. But look what he's done. He's begun the engagement. He's not afraid of what others believe. And he's coming at it rooted in his own sense, not an orthodox sense of what it means to be a Christian, but in his own understanding of what it takes to be a Christian. And that allows him to move forward in this endeavor, knowing who he is and not being frightened of what he might find. So how does all of this fit with religious pluralism? Adams' readings, Adams' experiences, what he watched convinced him that a state church was a dangerous idea. Why had Adam's forefathers and mothers come to America? To get rid of the Church of England, right? They felt oppressed by a state church. It was too Catholic. His thinking was any reasonable Calvinist could say we ought not to have some, right? That's what we fled. So why are we forcing other religions to pay a tithe to fund our ministers? More deeply, as a Calvinist, he looks around. And in the debates over the Constitution, he looks and says, oh my God, the Baptists, the Presbyterians, they're growing faster than we are. What if the Virginians, who are equal our numbers in 1786, 1787, what if the Virginians say the Anglican Church will be the church. What we need is compromise. An understanding, if you will. Not out of fear, but to protect the minority. We don't know what the future will hold. Adams would write. So you don't want a state church, a state religion, because that religion might change. It certainly had in England. As I've said, Adams looked at these various sects, and he worried less about some oath, about the prayers you said. Now, he had a very difficult time with the Catholics, as I've said, not because necessarily what they believed, but because of how they practiced. Latin, he felt, hindered. Latin, and this is the Calvinism, I love this, incense and songs. Right? Here's why I always think of this. They have no track, they don't do anything. And so he felt that these were superfluous, and they kept people away from what they really ought to be doing. So he looked at them and he said, well, we should allow Catholics and we shouldn't persecute them and we should allow them to worship openly and we shouldn't tithe and make Catholics pay. Not because he agreed with the policy, but because he agreed with how they were living, that they practiced good works, that they seemed to have justice, that they seemed to have piety, that they had these, which he thought was way too many, which is why they'd never get ahead in society, these religious days, my God. But they seem to live by his standard, a Christian. And to say they're not Christian was a red herring. He rejects the Trinity because it makes no sense. It's non-provable. You would never... Now, part of this is, right, let's go Freudian, his frustration with John Quincy. Right? John Quincy not following the Father, and this gives the equality. You know, that bothers Adam. There ought to be a hierarchy in society. Okay, but by and large, he becomes a Unitarian because it's inconceivable to him that God, the Son, would be crucified and could die and could be resurrected. It just doesn't make sense. So he becomes a Unitarian. And lastly, I think, and then I do have one more slide. Adams teaches us that we have to engage. It does no good to talk among, if you will, the believers, the converted, those who agree with us. You don't have to necessarily agree. Adams never agreed with Abbey, with the Abbey, or with the Iman, or with Thomas Jefferson, or his own priest, clergyman. But he engaged them. And what he wanted was respect for the engagement.
Did he write about who he thought Jesus was?
Yes, and afterwards I can actually get there. He wrote in 1822 a 14 or 16, maybe it was even longer, series in the Forerunner of the American Nation on his religious beliefs. And that was serialized. And so he was up front with his arguments. But by the time he wrote it, the president of Harvard Divinity School is a Unitarian. And Unitarianism has become the religion of the day among the Brahmin of Boston. And so it was safe, as opposed to 1792. I think in 1792 no one would have cared what he wrote. We had far more important issues than John Adams. And we had no Google, so we couldn't find out what he wrote once it went out of print. And the other is, right, that engagement for Adams does not mean wholehearted acceptance. I think there's a fear that if we acknowledge the other side point, and I don't mean this in a religious sense, I just mean in general, that somehow we've lessened ourselves as opposed to gained. And Adams was adamant that the only way to know is to engage, to find out, even if it took me places I didn't want to go. So, his goal is to understand where the other's coming from, to see how it fits with what he's doing, and either improve his knowledge, rethink his position, or say, oh, that's nice, and go on. So what do we do with this? What? And I do want to thank Holden for allowing me to get a couple of their... I went up and Googled a couple pictures for other ones. They asked us not to do a lot, so that's why. What I'd like to suggest makes Adams important is not his understanding of why religious pluralism could and should exist, but he lived by the convictions he ultimately derived. When he opted to end the war of 1790, called the Quasi-War with France, he knew he was done politically. But he sacrificed his own political career, and he thought his fame. He thought no one would remember him. And if you saw the mini-series, there's that picture of him shoveling manure in the back of Braintree, right? And he's complaining, right, they'll all remember Washington. They'll all remember Jefferson. My empire's a pile of manure. He wrote that because he was convinced that decision had written him out of history. The other thing that I really see as relevant for today is this emphasis on orthodoxy. Do you fit the test? Are you one of us? And we can each pick our own list of criteria. And we say, oh, you got 9 of 10. I'll make the 10th one the important one. As opposed to saying, how are they living? How are they making decisions? Is this the type of leader or person in responsibility that I would want? And I don't think it's just president. I would say it's true for a college president. I'd hope it's true for a faculty member, for a clergyman, or woman. I'm Catholic, so it's still man. You know, but that kind of, we get too focused on what's missing. And lastly, and this is the last one, are we willing to engage the other? And I'll give you an example that just came. We are still using, right, Islamist president of Egypt for Morsi, as opposed to saying the president of Egypt, Morsi. We've prejudged what by saying Islamist president, what his agenda is. That's not engagement. That's both projection and rejection. And Adams would have been the first to kind of call and say, enough. We may not like his religion. We may not like what he stands for, but he's the president. And that's an important kind of mark of a statesman, that he was willing to engage. So I've got 2 minutes. Before you walked in, I said you gave me this slot because you knew I had to be done so that people could get to chapel on time. So I wouldn't go long.
What would Adams have done with Cuba?
With Cuba today?
Yeah, engagement. Versus the...
Yeah, Adams is not. Now, this again will be part of his kind of provincial New England. Adams rejects economic coercion. But he does so because he believes it hurts New England more than it helps the nation at large. So Adams would most likely have tried to open up the economics and try to figure out another way to do it. But it has to do with where he is located, his rejection of economic coercion. He would have had a hard time with the atheism. It's one thing to be a different religion, it's another thing to be an atheist.
Did John Adams and Abigail agree on religion?
I'm going to give you, I've not delved deeply into their religious correspondence. Abigail really disliked the masculine nature of Calvinism. As she disliked the kind of growing... One of the things forgotten is, as the Constitution gets formed, women lose rights that they had. And she's quite upset with John at that. But she would argue, when it came to John Quincy, that he had used his reason, and he had read the same books, and that John should accept a different conclusion if he really wanted to live by his principles.
So you said he rejected the Trinity. What did he say about Jesus? Is he an example or a prophet or nothing?
I don't know. You know, to be honest, I didn't look at how he reconciled that. But tomorrow, Jefferson has some very specific ways of dealing with it. I don't know. I was satisfied, having looked at Jefferson for tomorrow, that I could kind of deal with why they rejected it. I think Adams just has a hard time with the notion that God... Well, actually, I take it back. I'm thinking about a passage from Thea's book. Why would God, if we were so sinful, crucify himself on our behalf? We'd all be damned. So it has more to do with his rejection of the crucifixion. It's more to do with his rejection of Calvin, the Calvinist perception of human nature. Then I think if he had said he died for the future, for us too, you know, because we ultimately are savable, he would have been. It would have been a much easier text. But
And Jonathan Edwards certainly embodies that.
So, but that's just from a brief passage in Facebook.